I'm Dimae Roberts, stage and studio. We're listening to Elk Soldiers, led by Glenn Drapeau, which is featured in Crossing, Minnesota. Today, I talk with Native American playwright, activist, and attorney Mary Catherine Nagel in a world premiere play, which opens, and it's Crossing, Minnesota, April 13th at Portland Center Stage. And in the second half of the show, we check in with director William Earl Ray about Passing Arts production of the No Play by the late John Henry Redwood. The show deals with history from the Jim Crow era of North Carolina and runs through April 14th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center. Important theater being done in Portland, so stay tuned for some enlightening conversations here on Stage and Studio. I'm Dimae Roberts. Mary Catherine Nagel is an enrolled citizen of the Cherokee Nation. She currently serves as the executive director of the Yale Indigenous Performing Arts Program. She's also a partner at Pipestem Law PC, where she works to protect tribal sovereignty and the inherent right of Indian nations to protect their women and children from domestic violence and sexual assault. And she is also one of the top playwrights in the country, about to open a commissioned world premiere work at Portland Center Stage at the Armory. It's called Crossing, Minnesota. With me live via phone is Mary Catherine Nagel. Mary, are you there?
Yes, hi, I'm here.
Oh, gosh. I don't know how much of that you've heard, but I've been talking about you. So I gave the introduction about you, and I'm so glad to have you here on stage and studio. And I was telling the audience that I really fell in love with your work at when I saw OSF's Manhattan, and how you juxtaposed the historic appropriation of Manhattan from indigenous peoples with the contemporary story of the lawyer and her family who are trying to keep the traditions and culture alive. And it seems like with Crossing, Minnesota, that you're juxtaposing history again with another pressing contemporary issue. Can you tell us more about that?
Sure. So, the story of Sacagawea honestly has been used and extrapolated by many people for different purposes. I think there's a whole mythology that a lot of Americans hold around Sacagawea and what, Lewis and Clark were doing when they were crossing the Missouri River. But really, Lewis and Clark's journey was a part of Manifest Destiny, and it was about conquest. The United States had just purchased the Louisiana Purchase, and the mission of Lewis and Clark was to make sure that everyone knew the United States owned that land now, even though tribal nations had not signed over their sovereign authority over the land. When the Dakota Access Pipeline controversy came about in 2016, the battleground was really right there on the Missouri River, right where Lewis and Clark picked up Sacagawea. And so, again, Lewis and Clark were a part of the Army Corps of Discovery. And today we have the Army Corps of Engineers granting easements to private companies to destroy sacred burial sites and threaten the drinking water of, a tribal nation who has a treaty right to protect its sacred sites and drinking water. Oh, sorry, I apologize. I was inside, but my cell phone you couldn't hear me when I talked, so I came outside.
Oh, that's what happened.
Loud out here.
Yeah, well, that's what happens with live radio. So this is a live radio show.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to ask you too. There was a wonderful production here some years ago at Oregon Children's Theater that used the Hidatsu pronunciation of Sacagawea, and I was wondering, did you consider using a different pronunciation of Sacagawea? That's the pronunciation, of course, that I've been here since I was 10 years old, and we, the mythology of Lewis and Clark, mm-hmm. and the real story of Sacagawea, wasn't really told then, but I was just wondering if you
sure.
considered that.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, I'm not an expert on who Sacagawea was. I'm not a relative of hers. I'm not from the same tribal nation. So I asked some of her descendants at Fort Hall,
where
the Shoshone Bannock tribes are located, and they told me that really in Shoshone her name is Sacagawea.
Okay.
Of course, no one pronounces her name in Shoshone. She was Shoshone. I think there's really not a lot of dispute about how the history went. She was kidnapped by a Hidatsa raiding party when she was pretty young and brought to live, with the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara over there in what is now North Dakota. But she is Shoshone, and so her name in Shoshone is Sacagawea, and she says that in the play. But of course, Lewis and Clark wrote her name in the journal as Sacagawea, and that's what a lot of white historians say is her name, because that's what the white guy said.
That is so interesting. So you do cover that, I mean, that in of itself is, you know, tells so much about how history is rewritten, you know, from the white perspective, right? And so that in of itself is in Crossing Minnishoshi. That's great. I was wondering, you know, how you've interspersed the story of the Dakota Pipeline and this story of Sakat. Now I don't know how to Sakatsawea together in Crossing Minnishoshi.
Yeah, I think it's important that. I think part of the success of what happened in 2016 and why the movement was so inspiring to so many is that it was actually a movement led and began by Native youth. The youth at Standing Rock and the youth from Cheyenne River Sioux, from the tribal nations there in the Great Sioux Nation, who said, it was their youth, who said, we're going to run to Omaha and deliver a petition to the Army Corps of Engineers. We're going to run to Washington, D.C. and deliver a petition to the United States President. They told their story, and the media picked up their story, interviewed them, featured it, and instead of having a story told by non-Natives about Native people, Americans were actually in their own living room listening to what Native people, and in particular Native youth, had to say about their treaty rights, their right to protect burial grounds, their right to protect their drinking water, and that was really powerful, and in some ways that's kind of what Sacagawea represents, right? She was a Native youth who some white guys actually listened to, because if they hadn't, they wouldn't have made it to the Pacific Ocean. I think so often it's Native stories in this country, in the United States, are told from a non-Native perspective for purposes of satisfying the entertainment values of a non-Native audience. I was going to say, and when we can start to change that, and we can start to listen to Native people share their own stories, which is what happened at Standing Rock, I think really powerful messages come from that.
And this seems like a powerful play. It seems like you've figured out a way to combine your activism and your legal career and your artistic writing in a successful way, and that must be really challenging.
Well, it is a little bit. it becomes mostly about time management, but you know, the different forms of writing really complement one another in a lot of ways. And so I'm blessed. I'm truly blessed that I get to do them both.
Well, how involved have you been with the production at Portland Center Stage? I know that you have a director that you've worked with for many years involved in it as well.
Yeah, I love working with Molly Smith. She's brilliant. She is she's brilliant. That's one thing. She's also just super dedicated to the authenticity of the representations. And so we're working with, we have a hired Shoshone cultural consultant and a Dakota cultural consultant. And, you know, we know we're not doing this play to give a 100% historically accurate portrayal. That's not the purpose of it. We're communicating a creative artistic message. But at the same time, she really respects my desire to be respectful of the Shoshone and Dakota people whose cultures we are exhibiting on stage by putting their characters on stage. And that's not something that's easily done. And so she puts a lot of extra time and energy into making sure that our process is respectful of those cultures and that we're not dehumanizing folks on stage, which, to be quite honest, the majority of American theater, if there's a quote-unquote Native person on stage, it's been, you know, over history and over time for purposes of dehumanizing Native people, using them as a commodity, as a joke, as a people, we're still, you know, in plays that are on Broadway and featured by major regional theater institutions, we're still something that gets murdered, or, you know, we're the butt of the joke. I mean, it's taken a lot to convince theatrical institutions that we deserve a seat at the table and that our people should not be dehumanized on stage. But Molly is just totally on board with that.
Oh, it sounds fabulous. And, you know, Sacagawea is one of the first women of color that I, you know, learned about, you know, when I was going to school here, elementary school here in not in Portland, but in Oregon. And I was wondering how you portray her feminist side.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, by our contemporary terms, she very much is a feminist. She was, you know, a very strong woman, but she was really a girl at that time. I mean, she was like 14 or when she went on this, you know, journey with Lewis and Clark, and she was a mother, of course, at that time, but she was kidnapped when she was a young child. Then she was sold to be married to this French fur trader named Charbonneau, who was physically and sexually abusive and violent.
Yeah.
So she was, you know, a victim of kidnapping, rape, abuse, repeated physical abuse. She's a survivor. At the same time that she's surviving all these heinous repeated crimes and living in an environment of extreme abuse, she's guiding these lost white folks over the mountains because they have no idea where they're going, securing them things like food and horses, and ensuring that to the best that she can, she can't control their behavior, but to the best that she can, that they have peaceful interactions with all the tribal nations they encounter. You know, this is someone who is incredibly brilliant and incredibly emotionally intelligent, especially for someone who's only 14 or 15 or 16, as she was during the course of this journey with Lewis and Clark. So I think she's incredibly brave. I think she's incredibly smart. We don't, you know, most of what we understand in America about the Lewis and Clark journey comes from their journals. And, you know, again, we're still, this is the Me Too movement. We're post-Me Too movement, right?
Right.
Lewis and Clark was almost 200 years before the Me Too movement. So they weren't really that concerned with how often her husband beat her or what trials or tribulations she faced, or even that there was a woman in the party with them. You know, back then, women weren't really, you know, in some ways human in the United States, right? So so the story that's been told so far largely erases her because, of course, the American culture at that time said women are not important, we're not relevant, we're not significant enough to be a part of the story. And my question to America today is, you know, are we ready to look at her honestly? And there's some things we know, some things we don't know. I encourage everyone to look to her tribe and her descendants as a resource for who she truly is, instead of the Lewis and Clark journals. But again, we're a society that likes to look to what white men wrote about history as opposed to what, you know, descendants of the Native people who were there at the same time say about that same history.
Wow. I am so glad, Mary Catherine Nagle, that the Portland Center Stage, you know, commissioned you to do this world premiere, because it sounds like another important work and one that, you know, closely ties to the Northwest and to Oregon history. So I'm just so pleased that this is happening. Are you going to be here for the opening?
I will be.
Oh,
I'm
good.
Very excited to be there for opening, and I hope to see lots of folks there that weekend.
Well, and what's up for you after the PCS production? Are you working on another show?
Well, I actually have, I will have a production of my play Sovereignty at the Marin Theater Company just outside of the Bay Area in California in next October.
Wow. And briefly, what is Sovereignty about?
It's about my grandfather's and Cherokee Nation, and it's a very personal story. It does have a lot of family ties to my specific family. But it really ultimately is about Cherokee Nation's fight to save the sovereignty of the nation when President Andrew Jackson and Congress were doing everything they could to eradicate us and to remove us.
I'm so glad that this is all happening, and it's just long overdue. Mary Catherine Nagle, a pleasure to talk with you today. Thanks for, you know, being available by phone, and thanks for all this info, and I look forward someday to meet you.
Yes, thank you so much. I really enjoyed it.
I'm going to go ahead and give some info, but thanks so much for today and for this talk. Take care. Crossing Minnishoshi, Portland Center Stage at the Armory. The show opens April 13th and continues through May 5th, and it's at the Armory, 128 Northwest 11th Avenue in Portland. You can get info at pcs.org or 503-445-3700, and it's for ages 15 and up. Up next, we have William Earl Ray, director of Pass and Arts production of The No Play, after this short break. I'm DMA Roberts, and that was a little button music from Portland musician and composer David Ornette Cherry at davidornettecherry.com. With me via phone is director William Earl Ray. Bill, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey there. I'm sorry I missed you when you were in Portland, but I heard a little story that you might be back in Portland, maybe even permanently. Is that true?
That is true.
When is that happening?
Well, at the moment... the ideal time right now, it looks like it's going to fall. Well, it's looking like it's between August and and First Fall.
Wow, so you are making the move. I mean, what is it about Portland? I mean, I am so glad. We definitely need more artists of color here, but I just, what is it, you know, that keeps drawing you here?
Work.
Well, I'm glad that there's work. The No Play, which is the work that you just did, is by the late John Henry Redwood. Did you know Mr. Redwood?
John Henry Redwood. I was there in France.
Yeah, yes. And I understand it wasn't really produced until after his death, and that's such a tragedy. But it's such an important work, and I'm glad that Passant Art Theater is doing it. And it's history from the Jim Crow era of North Carolina, and it runs through April 14th at the Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center. Can you tell us about what the No Play chronicles during the period of 1949 in Halifax, North Carolina, when it was common to see these no signs against blacks and Jews in the area?
What was it, common?
Well, I'm just, yeah, what is it, what does the story that it chronicles about this time period?
Well, you know, I grew up in that time period too. I grew up seeing those signs, mostly pertaining to me, colored, white, colored. You know,
We can't really say what it is because it's such horrific, you know, language. But yeah. So I didn't realize that you had to face those signs when you were growing up.
When I was a kid, I saw those signs for the first part of my life, and trying to comprehend. I saw water fountains that was for whites only, colors only, you know. I sort of grew up in that sort of, I call it mess. I wouldn't be surprised if I saw some today.
Yeah, actually, that's what I was going to ask you about, is how it pertains to contemporary times. And we're seeing more of those signs, aren't we?
I think, not as visual as they were then, but you, in the language and the attitudes, you still see those signs with the attitudes of the people, the climate that we're living in, the hatred that's regurgitating. You're seeing them again.
How hard is it for you to direct something that, you know, must have had such a, you know, well, lasting impression is like a soft way of saying it, but, you know, that affected you so much when you were growing up. How hard is it to delve into that as you direct this play that captures that time period?
Well, of course, it brings up emotions.
Yeah.
I think you have to separate that, though, if you're gonna do the work. You can't judge it. You just have to. You have to go at it, and you have to really understand what those feelings are. And I think the best thing to do with that is that we talk about it. We did a lot of talking about this play when we sat down. We talked about it, and it's interesting because every time we got to a place to where we were having some personal issues or they came up, a conversation would start, and then we get away from rehearsing to talking about the situation. And I think that the good thing about this too, and all this, is that we have two young people in this play, and they were able to grab a lot of knowledge from those of us who knew a lot about it or read about it or lived through it. And that's probably only I'm gonna say. In the internal cast, I think the two oldest would be myself and the one person that's playing the Jewish guy. and he obviously went through a lot of that himself as a Jewish person.
And that's the character of Yevheni Aronson, and he becomes an ally then to the main characters of Maddie Cheeks, and I don't remember the husband's name, but he's played by KPBS James Dixon. And so they all become, I guess, allies with each other during this time period?
No, they all become allies. And what's good about, what's interesting about this play is that everybody in some way finds some redemption in this play. And you have to be able to come see it to understand that. I don't want to give away anything in regards to how they receive redemption, but they do. They all in one way or another receive redemption. And that's all the way down to the littlest one, who's 11-year-old, who also in some way receives redemption. The sister receives it. Yavani receives it. The mother, Maddie, receives it. There's another character in the play. She receives it, Aunt Cora. They all, in their way, receive some type of redemption in this play.
And what does that redemption symbolize for you?
Hope.
Okay.
Clarity. Moving forward.
And so when I earlier asked you about how the No play speaks to modern times, what can we get from this play that will help us with what all those words you just said, you know, redemption, hope, clarity?
Are you still there?
Yeah. I was just, that was my question.
Okay.
That's a tough one. I know. But what does it say to us now?
We still need to talk. We still need to have an open dialogue. We still need to be able to. We have to understand that there are more of us than of them.
Yeah.
And I think that once we realize that in numbers, things will have to change. They have changed. They've always changed. Once we got out there in numbers, they've had to change. You know, you still have you have a lot of diehards now who will fight to the end to keep going in the wrong direction. You have a political system now that is the most totally corrupt system I've ever seen in my lifetime.
And that's saying a lot. That's saying a lot. You know, when we talked about your growing up, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, and it's true. When you look at Wisconsin right now, with the situation there, where the people have voted what they wanted in, and the diehard Republicans are saying, "Well, we're going to change some laws here." I'm thinking, wait a minute, how can you do that?
Wow.
The people have spoken. How can you just say we're going to change? So that's why it's corrupt. And I don't think they're going to get away with it, because the people have spoken again. The people have stepped up and proven that they can win in numbers, and they can change things in numbers. So we still have to, even though we see it keep going backwards or forward or whatever, we still have to continue that fight. We still have to get out. You know, I know you're tired. I'm tired. I'm tired of seeing that same fight. You know, I'm tired of dealing with what we dealt with in 1949.
But it sounds like this play is, you know, when you speak about redemption and hope, and, you know, that this play hopefully brings us to that point where we're energized, you know, to be able to do something about this, right? Because we don't want that history to repeat.
That is true, and I think we saw that in the first. There's two talkbacks for this show. One I was there for, and the other one is coming up this coming Sunday. And
we're coming up to the close here, Bill. So yeah, maybe like 30 seconds.
That was a lot of hope in that conversation with the talkback. So people are willing to sit and talk and do more, and not just come to the theater, sit there and together, and then leave and do nothing. And that's the thing that we have to do. We have to get out and do those things, and not just talk about it.
And it's an important work for Passant Art Theater, Bill. And I'm looking forward to seeing you, I guess, permanently when you move here. So thanks so much for making the time to talk about this. I'm going to give more info about the play, but it's so good to hear your voice and to talk with you today. You take care.
Okay, you too.
The No Play by, and that was William Earl Ray, the director of The No Play by John Henry Redwood. And it runs through April 14th at Passant Art Theater, Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. All shows at the IFCC, Interstate Firehouse Cultural Center, at 5340 North Interstate Avenue. More info at Passant, P-A-S-S-I-N, PassantArt.org. And I have all that info at stageandstudio.org and kbu.fm/stageandstudio, where you have a podcast of the show later today. That's it for Stage and Studio. I'm Dee Mae Roberts. Till next time.